From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about a symposium that's bringing together healthcare professionals to improve Black maternal and infant outcomes. Then we'll learn about the green initiatives at work at Stone Creek Coffee and how they're navigating that work with tariffs.
We're not going to stop paying fair prices to farmers. We're not going to stop trying to do what's better for the planet. Like, we're going to fight through it. And we fought through other things. We've been around for 30 years as a small local business. You got to get over some hurdles to do that. And we're going to continue that work.
Plus, we'll look at what Milwaukee landmarks, businesses, and architectural phenomena have been shaped by immigrant communities.
It's very different for me as somebody who comes from the East Coast, where, you know, you have Rockefeller Center and Lincoln Center. You have the Yankee names on all. You know, here the names on our high culture places are German.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll start today with Milwaukee's annual Black Birth Symposium. The one-day event is now in its fourth year. It convenes community members, researchers, healthcare providers, and advocates to address disparities in Black maternal and infant health. In Wisconsin, Black women are nearly three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications than white women. And Black infants in Milwaukee are three times more likely to die before their first birthday than white infants. The symposium's organizers hope that attendees will learn from each other and apply that knowledge to their work to improve those statistics. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, is joined by Gerard Blanks, the managing and creative director for Culture by Design, which is one of the groups organizing the event.
The symposium it's a space for people who work in the healthcare industry, but specifically in maternal and infant health. So the idea is that we convene this fairly large group of healthcare providers, advocates, clinicians, activists, the whole thing, right? So think of everyone from a doula to a physician, right? An academic to an activist, someone that is really working to bring attention to the issues, the disparities or health inequities that exist. And so we bring this group together for the symposium once a year, but we also stay connected with the group. We have a couple of other events throughout the year to kind of give people updates and stay connected. But it's really about bringing those folks together. One of the things that we realized was if you work at Frederick Hospital, where are the opportunities for you to come in contact with someone from maybe an Ascension Hospital, right? Or Advocate Aurora. You all do this really important work and you're very passionate about it, but how do you come together to share information and really collaborate? So that's what this is about.
What's the ultimate goal?
So I think first and foremost, it's important to point out that it's not a conference or a convention where we know we can't solve the problem in a day, right? Mm-hmm. The idea is, I think, primarily to get people in the room who may or may not otherwise connect, get them connected. That's really the biggest part of this, is to get folks connected, because ideally you build this network of folks that work from different organizations and at different sort of entry points and different levels, but are all kind of connected because through Black birth, right? And ideally, it is that collaboration. Collaboration, Taryn, is one of those words that people love to use and is not nearly as simple as we like to make it. It's really more difficult sometimes than we think. And so that is an essential part of this. Just, I work at this organization, you work at this organization. How would we collaborate if we didn't have this thing that brings us together?
Mm.
So that's the first part. Then the second part is there is a really a more academic aspect to it, where people are talking about best practices. People mm-hmm. are sharing information about new research. That's a big part. So like our keynote this year, Dr. Tiffany Green, she was a part of a report that came out last year on the state of maternal health care in Wisconsin, and she's going to be giving sort of a short or a brief sort of summary of that report. And that's in the morning before we go into the breakout sessions. So in each breakout session has a very specific or particular focus. The first year or so we did it, the breakout sessions were maybe a little too broad in scope. This year, so like we have two sessions just about C-sections, because that is a really big concern within maternal health care, is particularly among Black women. How many Black women are getting C-sections that don't necessarily need to get them? Like, my wife had a C-section for all of our kids. And so having the conversation about the concerns around that, right? That's one breakout session. So there's a learning part, the networking part, and then, like I said, the therapeutic, the sort of emotional healing, getting to talk to somebody about your challenges or struggles who has a unique perspective similar to yours. Or maybe has a different perspective, right? But it's still, you're hearing from someone that does the work.
Yeah.
Not just a random person with an opinion.
With this being the fourth year, what do you think that says about people's understanding of the significance of this issue, Black maternal health and infant health, especially here in Milwaukee?
I mean, it's interesting. When I got pulled into this, and I say pulled in because we've done quite a few events. Like, this is the fourth year of the symposium, but I've probably done double digits, like 10, 12 of like screenings, because that's how it started with films that we were showcasing, right? Mm-hmm. But when I started, I didn't know much about it, right? Like, I didn't know much about the issue at hand, right? Like the disparities for women of color, particularly Black women. I didn't realize that this is one of the number one issues in healthcare. I didn't know a lot of people that knew a lot about this. So I'm an academic, so I did a ton of research. But what's interesting, Taryn, is over the last 4 or 5 years, I'll have conversations with people I know that are well-versed on this, which is surprising. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, sometimes you can live in a bubble. And when I tell you, every Black woman in my life, from relatives to friends and colleagues, has a story. Mm-hmm. Some of them are really dire stories. Some of them are maybe less of a sort of dire circumstance, but they all have these stories. And it was so interesting over the years, even the men that I talked to, that had to become more knowledgeable because their wife went through this thing. Mm-hmm. So it's been kind of an amazing journey, because it went from something I didn't know much about to then feeling like, well, I know a lot more about this, but this is really more a part of this network I'm a part of, to now I have this conversation with so many people in my life. I just feel like it's starting to get more attention. At the same time, you don't hear about it like during election season at all, right? Like, you don't hear about it sort of in the mainstream news unless it's kind of connected to something like this, right? Mm-hmm. So I still feel like we have a long way to go. But I'm just surprised at how many conversations I have around this and how just knowledgeable the people I know are.
What do you want people to walk away with once this symposium wraps up?
I'll be honest, a lot of this, like we talked about earlier, sharing of information, learning and from one another, all those great things. At the end of the day, I'll be honest with you, I need for everybody that comes through to feel a sense of wellness and healing. The people that do this work, this is not a 40-hour a week sort of job, right? This is a career, a passion. These people are really, really passionate about the work they do. They know that it saves lives, and they want to be better at it. They want everyone to be better at it. I want to appreciate these folks because they're literally, when I say literally, they are saving women's lives.
Gerard Blanks is the Managing and Creative Director for Culture by Design, which is one of the groups organizing tomorrow's Black Birth Symposium. WUWM's Taryn Powell also spoke with Erica Wright, the Deputy Commissioner of Family and Community Health with the City of Milwaukee Health Department. They discussed the inequities in Black maternal and infant health.
Black babies are 2 to 3 times more likely to die or not make it to their first birthday. Black mothers are at least 2 times, if not 3 times, more likely to suffer different poor birthing outcomes, be it excessive medical interventions, death themselves, terrible postpartum, you know, implications, be it physically, mental health, just poor treatment during the process of, you know, their prenatal journey into the actual labor delivery process itself. And they're just at higher risk of really detrimental things happening to them more than any counterpart, particularly white counterpart. And the biggest piece is that 85% was the last I saw, 85% of the maternal poor outcomes or deaths are preventable. And that's the part that stood out the most, because I'm like, this isn't like there's something specific to the Black culture that's causing us to, you know, be at more risk of dying or, you know, adverse outcomes. It's literally, what are our resources, our treatment, the quality of care, the access of care, the equity that, you know, or I should say the inequity that we face. And I say we as a Black woman that I identify, that we face in the healthcare and, you know, Western medicine. I mean, Western medicine was based off of the experimentation degradation of, you know, people of color. So, you know, we're really talking about kind of the root causes of why are we seeing these outcomes in our babies and our birthing people and our moms. I'm like, this is rooted in almost anything in the social determinants of health space. You're talking about unsafe housing, unhealthy foods, lack of livable wages, poor quality healthcare, chronic medical problems rooted in the lack of preventative cares. I mean, the list goes on that culminates into this space of, you know, maternal and child health. And we consistently see these statistics be pretty high in regards to the disparities of Black babies versus any other race.
You know, you mentioned root causes. Let's talk a little bit more about how we got here and what's happening when Black women are going to the doctor.
So I'll separate that answer in two. So historically speaking, I mean, let's just go to the fact that race is a social construct. It's deeply embedded in our society, our economy, our laws, our standards of practice, our beliefs. And that trickles into the mistreatment, the continued systemic oppressions, the hierarchy that we see in, you know, the healthcare in particular, where I'm like, when we see data around medical professionals and their biases, where you're seeing statistically, they still are believing some of the myths from decades, if not centuries ago, where it's like Black people have thicker skin, higher pain tolerance, have other like medical implications that I'm like, that's not specific to Black people. And this is, again, reflective of the poor, you know, medical studies in history that really do not reflect our needs and the unfortunate opportunistic, you know, spaces in, you know, Western medicine that lent to malpractice type of situations happening to Black and brown people. There's a lot of explicit and implicit bias that still exists in that space in particular. So, you know, when we're kind of getting back into the birthing space and maternal child health arena, you know, we see women that are seeking care and they're treated differently. They are questioned more if they're seeking pain relief. So, you know, a person that's going through labor and is asking like, I need something to help, there's more resistance and questioning as to why she's asking for, you know, pain relief than a white person. Kind of assuming that, is she drug seeking, is, you know, again, some of the myths of the past, like, oh, you have a higher pain tolerance, so they dismiss it a lot more often than not. We've had moms that have died out for bleed outs because they've been crying out saying something is wrong with me, please take me seriously, and are not taken seriously. They're either dismissed or minimized or misdiagnosed. And again, that's all rooted in more of that bias that's built into the healthcare systems. And, you know, do I believe that like there's all terrible people in healthcare? Absolutely not. But there's a lot of roots in the education pathway to become, you know, medical providers, the standards of practice around, you know, understanding the unique needs of race and, you know, not playing into the historical myths of sorts around, you know, women's bodies. Black people are just often villainized more than, you know, white people. So if, you know, somebody's expressing frustration, if they're upset, if they're mad, we're looked at as, you know, starting problems and being combative versus I'm trying to advocate for myself and say something's wrong and I need help and I'm looking to you as the professional to help me.
And so that's where the symposium comes in.
Yes, it is.
Tell me a little bit more, just about the impact, the potential impact that this symposium can have, in addressing Black maternal and infant health.
I think the first piece of it is just awareness to start, where for those that are not aware of the blaring statistics that we have, and this isn't just Milwaukee, Wisconsin, this is national where we see these kind of statistics play out, but you know, it is fairly pervasive in our city. So one is awareness. And you know, there's a lot of different types of conferences, symposiums, things like that that are talking about maternal child health, but may not explicitly call out like, this is the population that is at highest risk. This is the population that has the highest disparities and needs and gaps. And again, tapping back into the preventable pieces of this, where I'm like, there's got to be a lot more ownership across those that are charged in any part of the spectrum of, you know, prenatal to postpartum arena. So, I mean, this is our community providers, our hospitals, doulas, CEOs, insurance. I mean, anything that is influencing the pregnancy and, you know, maternal child health space, I'm like, this is like a call to action type of feel where I'm like, we're bringing this to your awareness. We're constantly putting this on a pedestal and a platform so that it can't get dismissed or minimized, and trying to call for some radical innovation to happen, and reminding people that this is affecting the entire community. And like, even though, yes, you know, Black people are the most afflicted in this space, like there shouldn't be any kind of infant or maternal morbidity or mortality happening. So that's, you know, like kind of the overarching umbrella of it all. Like so much of this is preventable, but this under that umbrella specifically, our Black, you know, population is struggling. And also recognizing that we can't treat this in a vacuum. Like this is going to be an all hands on deck. How do we reestablish the village? Because we were giving birth to babies since the dawn of time before Western medicine. And like, how did we get here to see such, you know, terrible outcomes in a time that we have the most modern medicine available to us? And I'm like, this is very contrary. And I'm like, okay, how do we use this space to convene the right parties so that we are all hearing the same messages, testimonies, data, research, anything that's relevant to, you know, help educate people that may not have been fully abreast of like how big of a problem this is and what's their role in helping, because we have to tackle this kind of going back to everything I listed before of like, this is housing, food, healthcare, insurance, benefits, childcare, income, like all of these spaces influence the health and outcomes of our babies and our moms. So like, how are we tackling this from all avenues? Because not any one of us can solve this problem.
Erica Wright is the Deputy Commissioner of Family and Community Health with the City of Milwaukee Health Department. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. The fourth annual Black Birth Symposium is happening tomorrow at the Baird Center. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn how the impact of immigrants shows up in some of Milwaukee's most beloved businesses, festivals, and architecture. But first, we'll speak with Stone Creek's Director of Development to learn about the company's efforts to make their coffee business environmentally friendly. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Stone Creek Coffee opened its first cafe in 1993. Since then, the company has grown, much like Milwaukee's own vibrant coffee scene. Since its inception, Stone Creek founder and co-owner Eric Reich has aimed to operate a business that can be both, quote, radically human and profitable at the same time. Part of that mission is not only changing with the coffee landscape to source more responsibly, but also enacting green initiatives that help offset the necessity of depending on global distribution of coffee beans. To share more about Stone Creek's sustainability efforts, I'm joined by Drew Pond, Stone Creek's Director of Development. He begins by explaining the challenges of navigating the coffee business, which wasn't built to be sustainable in the first place.
The coffee business, kind of like hospitality in the United States, were built on a minimum wage structure. In coffee, it was built really on kind of a colonial economic structure where coffee was brought in from Western European countries during colonial efforts. And then it was cultivated as a result of utilization of forced labor or, you know, labor that was less than well compensated. And then the coffee's exported, like all the coffee's exported then back to Western Europe and then to the United States over time. So that's how the industry got built, and that's how Western Civ kind of got used to drinking coffee on a daily basis, was through this economic structure that was never meant to benefit the people at origin countries growing coffee. So get to, you know, 1993, and everybody's used to drinking coffee every day, but not very many people have thought about where it came from. Or is this something that's economically sustainable, or is it environmentally sustainable? The hope of specialty coffee companies like Stone Creek and many others was that, hey, this product is so much deeper, so much more rich than a commodity, just like give me caffeine. It's this real craft beverage. And if we highlight the craft element of it, the uniqueness of certain coffees, we can create an economic model that is more sustainable, that has better economic benefit in these origin countries.
Right. And you reference 93, which was when Stone Creek first opened here in Milwaukee. And you are all working to prove that a business can be both, quote, radically human and profitable at the same time. So you touched upon that. How so? Like, what were some key challenges from its founding and that maybe you're still trying to work through up to now that you're aiming to strike this balance?
Yeah, I'd say it's easier to be radically human than profitable in coffee, unfortunately. But Eric's heartbeat when he started Stone Creek was the belief that all businesses have an obligation to their communities, to their employees, to their suppliers. The corporate name of Stone Creek Coffee is actually called Geary Corporation. It's Geary Corporation doing business as Stone Creek Coffee. And Geary, that term comes from a Japanese code of honor called Bushido, and it means social obligation, that you live with this obligation toward everybody with whom you come into contact. So that was the heartbeat that started Stone Creek, was can we create a business that's mindful of the impact that it has at every point in the supply chain? It exists to create that positive impact, not just to create profit. Now, one thing we say with regularity is we never recommend somebody get into coffee to make money, but it is an amazing environment to get into to create really dynamic relationships and create an environment that can be a catalyst for social conversations and change.
Among one of the many categories for change and also just being socially more aware is through environmentalism. So I'm sure a lot has changed since y'all first opened in 93, including the coffee landscape, of course. We've seen Milwaukee's scene just really explode. But can you share how your environmentally friendly efforts have started and changed over the years?
Yeah, I think we've learned a lot about what is or isn't environmentally sustainable. Going back to where coffee is grown, like for the first 20 years of Stone Creek Coffee, we sourced our coffee through importers, which added like a middleman into the process. Back in like 2012, we started sourcing coffee directly from farms. And at that point, we learned a great deal more about the work that needs to be done in origin countries to make it environmentally sustainable and sustainable economically for the farmer. So over the last now 13 years that we've been sourcing directly, we've been on a steep learning curve to support that work and to try and build deeper relationships with our farmers so that they can have the financial stability to do that work themselves. And then on the cafe side, we've just it's about making incremental change year after year to lessen our environmental impact. Because one thing about a lot of cafes is, particularly
cups and waste.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of built into the model is that it's all disposable, right? So, you know, we're always looking for cups, both, you know, the plastic to-go cups, the paper cups for the hot beverages. Like, can we find substrates and materials that have less of a negative environmental impact? A few years ago, we knew we had a rich resource in the coffee grounds we were using, but a lot of them just ended up getting thrown away. We would let customers take them if they wanted them, but we just threw a lot of these coffee grounds away. We started working with Compost Crusaders to make sure that that rich resource ended up getting back in a way that could benefit the community. It does cost us, like there's no financial benefit, but there's certainly an environmental benefit and a social benefit to working with Compost Crusaders.
Right, another local company as well. And to break down some more specifics of green initiatives, let's talk about, while we're on kind of the coffee product line here, the packaging. So I myself have brought back coffee bags to Stone Creek to be recycled, but can you explain to me the process of what happens after I hand one back to you guys?
Yes, yes. So our coffee bags within the Milwaukee recycling stream, number 4 LDPE, in certain communities can be recycled. So if it goes back in the recycling stream and not just thrown away, that plastic material can be reused. So not all plastic packaging substrates can be reused and not in all communities, but number 4 LDPE is one that more and more communities are onboarding as a recyclable material. And that's something that when we redid our packaging 3-4 years ago initially, that's we were trying to find something that could, at the very least, could be recycled. We wanted compostable, but there wasn't anything on the market at the time that made a lot of sense that we thought people would actually handle correctly. Because a lot of the compostable stuff isn't only compostable if you manage it just perfectly. So we wanted to take the recyclability approach because we felt like it was easier for the user to make sure it got in the right stream.
So bringing it back to the shops is a way to make sure that it's properly recycled. And do you guys have like a direct relationship or connection to the waste management that then takes that next step?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, yeah.
Gotcha. So another local green initiative is wind power. With over 90% of cafe energy sourced from local wind farms, first off, can you share where these are located and how does this process exactly work?
Yeah, well, We Energies actually has a great program where you can just opt in for it. It's as simple as flipping the right switch. And one thing we say a lot at Stone Creek is vote with your dollar. And unfortunately, sometimes doing environmental good costs more. The world is kind of backwards in that way. But you can just reach out as a homeowner, as a business owner, and opt in for the Energy for Tomorrow program, I believe that's what it's called, where you pay more to offset, you know, the costs to utilize the wind-powered energy, the wind farms in rural, there's several in rural Wisconsin, but that's the program that we utilize.
For sure. And we talked about this a bit earlier in our conversation, but that shift in 2012 to sourcing direct from coffee growers. Now, at the end of the day, coffee is a global market, right? And you have to source it from outside of the country. So can you explain some of the challenges that it took to take that step, but then also like what that presented for you as a company to be like, okay, if we're going to continue sourcing this way, like kind of offsetting that locally with other things you do to make up for the environmental impact of doing business out of necessity to the growers? Yeah.
Right, yeah. So, of course, we try to prioritize our local purchasing whenever possible, but there's no way you can source coffee locally given that it doesn't grow in Wisconsin, and the only place in the United States it grows is Hawaii, and then in very limited capacity. So going back to 2012, we started slowly sourcing from Guatemala and Costa Rica, and we've expanded those direct sourcing efforts to Nicaragua, and Colombia. We source a lot of coffee out of Colombia, and building those connections is pretty complicated because then you have to serve as an international food product importer. So certainly there's an environmental impact in then shipping the coffee from Costa Rica, Guatemala, Colombia, you know, full shipping containers, usually by boat, into a port on the East Coast or the West Coast by rail to Chicago and then by truck up to Milwaukee. There is certainly a lengthy farm-to-cup journey. Then when it gets back here, we try and make sure that we do everything we can to represent that product extremely well to the end consumer and do so in a way that is as mindful as possible in terms of both mitigating the waste and then making sure that that whole journey was worthwhile. We do believe that coffee is a unique product and that it has a social magnetism. And I used the word catalyst earlier. It itself as a product and the environments it creates kind of serve as a catalyst for people to connect and create reform, create change. So that's me getting a little poetic, but ultimately our goal is to be mindful of how that coffee gets utilized. That's why we work with Compost Crusaders in the event that, you know, it doesn't all get brewed or the coffee grounds need to go somewhere. And then we want to make sure that all the vessels that we're using and the power that we're using ultimately is as responsibly sourced as possible.
I'm just going to take a quick moment to reintroduce you. I'm Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski here with Drew Pond, Stone Creek's Director of Development. We've been talking about the company's green initiatives and the challenges that those present. Now, of course, the word of the day, of the month, of whatever you want to call it, is tariff. And the current economic climate, I'm sure, is impacting you at Stone Creek. So can you share a little bit about that right now? What are you kind of playing by ear out of necessity, you know, given that we're talking around end of April. So what's true to you at this moment, given that it could change?
So tariffs are hitting us pretty hard. And while it feels political, which is understandable, we didn't choose for it to be like it's not something that we chose. So as we approach this particular issue, it is important for us as a company to say, hey, we didn't choose these costs that are coming at us. We do believe that they're, you know, the result of at times irresponsible posturing. And now we face as much as $1.2 million of increased costs that we have to onboard over the next 6 months. I know because I did the calculations yesterday. that's something that as a small local business, we want to be transparent about is oftentimes in governmental politics, cases are made that this is going to be good for business. This is good for local business. Well, in this case, I can quantify most assuredly that this is not good for at least our local business to the tune of $1.2 million, which is much more than our net profitability is in an annual year. So the costs that we are going to incur as a result of the tariffs, if nothing changes from where we stand, is going to be quite a hurdle that we have to work through. So now ultimately we have to do something, right? Like if nothing changes here in the next few weeks, because our last container that just arrived got hit with $17,000 worth of tariffs, we have to do something in our pricing or we go out of business in a year. So we will be transparent with our customers and share, as I just shared with you, the net impact of what's happening to us, because it's happening to everybody. We all have to decide how to act. As I mentioned, we didn't choose it, but we are responsible with how we act on a go-forward basis. So we don't want to become inflammatory, but we want to be honest. And when we raise our prices, which we will have to do in some form or fashion, we want people to know exactly why that is. It's certainly, we're not crying poor. We're not just begging for more money. It's that if we don't raise our prices, that all those costs eat the net profitability completely away. We don't have more money to offset our employees' cost of living, which is going to go up as a result of the tariffs. Prices are going to have to go up. That is the
right
story.
And you know, you mentioned in our conversation about sustainability, some of these things you are opting into at a cost to you already.
Sure.
So
yeah.
What I'm curious about with the tariffs is that potentially on the table of altering how you guys are going about these initiatives that are costing you money at the moment to be more green and sustainable. You know, and obviously that's something that can't be decided right now, but with your commitment to sustainability, with the reality of like, we might have to adjust, kind of where's your mind sitting at with that right now?
That's such a good question. The answer to that is no. Like, we won't make any concessions in how we treat our employees. Like, we're committed to paying fair, which I'll say honestly, we haven't always paid fair. Like, that's been a journey for us over the last 5 years where we've gotten much more aggressive in fighting against what I talked about earlier, the history of hospitality paying benefits being crappy in the United States. So we're fighting against that, and we're at a point now where we pay basically at a living wage level for an individual, at least in the United States or in the Milwaukee area. We're not going back. And if we can't sustain that, then we're just not going to operate. and that's kind of what's at the table right now is, like, we're not going to stop paying fair prices to farmers. We're not going to stop trying to do what's better for the planet. Like, we're going to fight through it. And we fought through other things. We've been around for 30 years as a small local business. You got to get over some hurdles to do that. And we're going to continue that work. I don't know how we're going to do it, to be fully transparent. There's not a clear roadmap for navigating times like these. But we've got a great team. You know, we've got a lot of smart people working really hard, caring for each other. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
Well, Drew Pond, thanks so much for joining me to share more today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for giving Stone Creek a voice.
Drew Pond is the Director of Development at Stone Creek Coffee. You can find more information about their sustainability practices at WUWM.com. From Pabst Brewing to El Rey Supermarkets, Milwaukee is shaped by immigrant communities past and present. Next week, WUWM is taking a step back to explore Wisconsin's immigration history. Today, we'll learn how that history shows up in some of our city's most beloved businesses, festivals, and architecture. Here's WUWM reporter Catherine Kokel.
Our guide for this journey is UWM Professor of History, Rachel Buff. We start with the numerous indigenous peoples who lived here, where the rivers now called the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick converged. So many native words and tribal names are now part of our state maps. Winnebago, Chippewa, and Ashwaubenon, to name a few. Even the word Milwaukee is likely derived from an indigenous word. But settlers began to leave their mark, too. Here's Rachel Buff.
We have a French and a Métis, a mixed blood migration, and then some English folks coming in the 18th century as well. You can see it in Milwaukee's geography, like Yankee Hill. There are early, you know, kind of English, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants that are some of the first settlers.
Later, immigrant communities didn't just bring their names. They also brought their style of architecture and values. Polish immigrants to Milwaukee began arriving in the 1850s. Homes on the south side of the city show their influence.
The Polish flat, of course, are unique Milwaukee architecture where, you know, a family would really, Poles were very oriented culturally towards owning a piece of land, owning a house, so families would pool their resources and lift a small house up and put another floor on it so they would have more space and would be able to save money. That is a unique Milwaukee form of architecture that you can see on the south side, and it comes out of immigrant drive and ambition, and that was received as like, well, maybe they're not like us. Maybe they like living in basements. You know, that was the vibe in the early 20th century when immigration restriction was the rage.
Milwaukee also experienced a massive amount of German immigration from the 1840s through the 1890s. The city was once dubbed the German Athens, referencing the historic Greek city. German immigrants trained in politics became leaders in Milwaukee's socialist government, while entrepreneurs started breweries and tradesmen sold crafts and built businesses.
The kind of ending of the German Athens, of course, you know, we still see in the architecture of our city with Turner Hall, with Pabst, everything, with the big breweries. We still see the influence of Germans, but because of the repression against Germans, under actually the Alien Enemies Act, and the, you know, suspicion of them, that really is sort of the end of that height of German Milwaukee.
After the start of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, Buff explains that Mexican immigrants started moving to Texas and eventually to Wisconsin. She says that churches on the south side of the city began to open their doors for the new arrivals.
Sort of the transition of the south side of Milwaukee, which had been historically Polish. Again, you can still see that in the architecture, the churches, the businesses. But, you know, you have those churches kind of keeping business going by having Spanish-speaking masses.
More than 100 years later, Milwaukee's south side has transformed. Almost 70% of the residents on the near south side now identify as Hispanic or Latino, according to the U.S. Census. Buff says Milwaukee's map shows which immigrant communities were allowed to thrive and those that were left out. For example, she says one reason we don't have a Chinatown, similar to Chicago or New York, is because of extreme racism and xenophobia toward Chinese immigrants in the late 1800s. In 1889, Milwaukeeans even staged protests that ended in riots against Chinese laundrymen. In the end, all the groups that came to Milwaukee have made it special.
You can look at your map of Milwaukee, your imaginative map of Milwaukee, and you can see the presence in language, in words, in businesses. You can still go to Mater's. You know, there's Mexican restaurants. It's very different for me as somebody who comes from the East Coast, where, you know, you have Rockefeller Center and Lincoln Center. You have the Yankee names on all. You know, here the names on our high culture places are German, right? So it's written into our landscape, and it's our inheritance. It's why we have the segregation that we have. It's why we have the ongoing problems that we have that is structured in. So it's important for us to understand this, I think, both because it's our heritage. It's what's fun about ethnic festivals. It's what makes Milwaukee diverse and exciting and vital. And it's also the contested territory we still struggle with.
Today, Buff said she's excitedly following the opening of new Yemeni coffee shops and the growing Muslim American communities around the city. To see the contributions of Milwaukee's immigrant communities, both past and present, you don't need to look far.
That was WUWM's Catherine Kokel. Every day, there are new developments in the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration. Next week, WUWM is taking a step back to explore Wisconsin immigration history. We'll learn about the immigrant communities that have shaped Milwaukee, the refugees that found a safe haven here, and how immigration and citizenship laws have changed over time. Tune into Lake Effect all of next week to hear these stories. We'll take one more break and then learn about zombie trees, what they are, and why they're endangering Wisconsin communities. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As the seasons change and the weather becomes more unpredictable, storms and heavy winds could be creating a phenomenon known as zombie trees. To learn more, Lake Effect's Joy Powers is joined by arborist Adam Passo from Davy Tree Expert Company in Milwaukee.
We're going to start with the biggest question. What are zombie trees?
Yes. What are zombie trees? Zombie trees are trees that have been affected somehow by some outside factor. So it could be a high wind from a storm, could be drought. A lot of times it's things that you can't see as an untrained professional that are the scary part of the zombie trees is that, you know, there could be a crack from a high wind that it kind of twisted and it's just kind of sitting there in purgatory until it does something. It grows or it falls down. You could have drought where on the inside of the tree it kind of dries up, and that's where you could have some decay happening that you can't see. You know, there's also root issues that could be, you know, not visible to an untrained eye, and a certified arborist could see that there's some girdling roots, there's some root rot. You know, it's just a tree that looks okay. It's hanging in there, but a lot of times it's a slow decline. And then eventually you see the effects and it's devastating.
So essentially this is a tree that I might pass and go, fine looking tree, normal looking tree. But on the inside, it's dying.
Yep, exactly. You can have a crack that's really destabilizing that tree. And it's very fine crack, you know, that you just pass by it. There's no way you'd ever see it because of the bark, the texture of the bark. But there's ways that we can tell that something's just not right.
Now, this is an issue that has been growing for some reason. Why are we seeing these increasingly in Wisconsin and seemingly around the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting more extreme weather patterns, you know, higher winds during the spring. You know, it's always who knows what's going to happen. You get some major straight line winds coming through. You could even have some limbs that are hanging up in the canopy of a really leafy tree. Can't see it, but an arborist can definitely tell. And that's when who knows what happens. It can just sit there for months, you know, years even, and then it falls down.
And I guess that really gets to the issue with zombie trees, because you think, well, yeah, sure, you know, trees get sick, they die just like anything else. But it seems like one of the problems here is that these are trees that, for all intents and purposes, look fine and then kind of on a dime can die. And it seems like that's what causes the next problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's times I've been sitting in my truck. This happened recently. I was sitting in my truck and we had a really heavy wind the day before. I went to go look at a tree that was on a house. I was sitting in there in my truck, and about 15 yards behind me, this huge red oak just falls across the road for no apparent reason. It'd been sitting there, probably compromised from the wind, and it just, boom, down it goes, and it could hit me, could have hit anybody walking along. So it's kind of scary stuff.
For sure. I mean, it's almost like something falling from the sky, except it is basically falling from the sky to the side of you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a zombie eating brains, but it's just as scary.
Yeah. Now, what can you do? Because it seems like these are issues, at least some of them, that can be solved if you're able to find them.
Yeah, there's ways to protect trees, even if they're compromised. You know, there's cabling, bracing. There's ways that we can help the health of the tree. You know, maybe some pruning that will get rid of the hazard, and then the tree can, you know, trees are really resilient. They can figure out a way to take over whatever was lost. So that energy just gets redirected, and trees will survive at all costs.
Now, you've said a lot of the time it's difficult to know when this has started to happen to a tree. Are there little things that people can look out for to go, oh, this tree might have an issue?
Yeah. Yeah. The first sign is canopy decline. You know, the leaves were really nice size last year. This year, they're a little bit smaller. You can start seeing a little bit more light through the canopy. You know, even in a dense canopy, if right down the middle, you can see light through there. That's probably a bad junction, and it probably needs to be cabled together. If it's a whole kind of decline in the tree, you know, have somebody out. There could be something more sinister going on. We can help. If it's just, you know, an old tree that's kind of in decline, we can help that a lot. But you'll notice maybe a little light color on the bark. You know, it's a real dark bark, and then you see this line of light color. That's a dead giveaway that maybe there's a nasty crack that we can't see all the way through, but it's just the start.
It seems like really the last thing is taking down the whole tree. It seems like there's a variety of intervention methods before then, but when is it that we go, this tree's got to go?
Yeah, yeah. If you see some root heaving, you know, there could be the ground coming up a little bit on one side that you didn't really notice the other day. That's a big sign that the roots were severed. Sometimes those roots can be grown back. You'll see a hump around a tree. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a recent thing and the tree is compensated, put a bunch of roots out, and it's stabilized again. But a lot of times that's not going to happen. You know, one side of the tree will fracture, one side will, those cells will compress. Each situation is different. That's what's exciting about tree care, you know? We're all individuals, so are they. So it's just having a trained eye, take a look, and make sure that everybody's safe.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Adam Passo is a certified arborist and district manager for Davy Tree Expert Company in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2023. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excret Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Jimmy Gutierrez, Mayan Silver, Eddie Morales, Taryn Powell, and Catherine Kokel from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.